John Rivette with Jack Stever on June 13, 1989. Jack recently gave a speech to our alumni group on a separate video and audio tape for the second time. And it raised some issues in my interest about worker ed here in Michigan. Maybe just, if you're willing, as sort of quick background before you came here, just where you were born and why and how you got interested in labor relations.
Well, where I was born, I was born in Hungary. I was brought to the United States at the age of about 3 and a half. I don't remember anything at all about anything before I arrived here. Lived in Newark, New Jersey, probably for first 20 years of my life, or excluding the 3 and a half years before I arrived here. What else? That's the early years. I lived in New York for a while and went to City College of New York for a bachelor's degree. When I graduated from CCNY, it was February 1940. I really didn't have any particular plans. I majored in economics, probably took what labor economics courses they had, which wasn't very much, and looked for a job. One thing I remember in looking for a job was that all ads at that time, not all ads, but it was not at all unusual for advertisements in New York Times and elsewhere to indicate that they hired only Gentiles. Mm-hmm. And I would respond to those ads and just tell them that I was a Lutheran because my name was Lutheran. I remember once being interviewed by, I think it was Chase Manhattan Bank, and that question came up, and I said I was Lutheran, and then he surprised me by asking me what church I went to, and I just said I wasn't observant, but I think maybe it didn't sound entirely credible to him. But at any rate, after about 6 months, I had some part-time jobs. I lasted about one day in a shoe store after they learned that I really didn't have any experience selling shoes, especially to women. And maybe about 3 weeks or so selling wallpaper. I don't remember why I lost that job, but I didn't stay there too long. I used to work pretty regularly during that period, along as I did during the summers while I was in college and in the mountains in Mount Freedom in New Jersey. And when I graduated, I used to work there more than weekends for various events that they may have had. I think one noteworthy event that I can recall while working there in the summer, probably about 1939, was that we had a strike. It really wasn't a strike in a labor sense. I don't remember what it was over. One of the waiters, I think, was sleeping with a lot of the women. And whether or not why we should really go out on strike for him, I really don't know. But at any rate, we did, and as a result, we were all fired. And I remember going up. He lived in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, and he had a cottage up on some creek. I think it was called something like Perkiomen Creek. And after the strike, he invited me and another waiter to go up there, and we spent a week or so pitching horseshoes and doing not much else. Another event I remember was on Labor Day of 1939. I was working in a resort. I can't remember if it was in Lake Apatkong or up north. I think it was up north in northern New York, in the Catskills and the mountains there. I had, again, had to stretch a few things to say I was a waiter when actually I had always been a busboy. And that job didn't last long. I remember dropping a tray of dishes, and that's when I learned about the war starting in Europe. It must have been about September the 1st, 1939, when Germany moved against Poland. But for some reason, I guess I decided after talking with some people that going through school of social work was probably a good career move. Was during the Depression or shortly after that, and a lot of welfare workers and other people who were needed in the social work professions, and I applied and was accepted at the New York School of Social Work, which at that time was associated with Columbia University. But and I was there for four terms, which almost was enough to get a master's degree. I needed two more terms. It was a cooperative kind of school where we used to take courses one term and do field work. I did a field work term in the Social Security office up in Harlem. I remember one incident there where the manager of that, many of the employees as well as the manager were black. And of course, being in the area in which it was, most of our clients were black also. But this is probably a forerunner of the kind of thing that employers now do through much more sophisticated devices. But the manager of the firm used to be able to see from his office. He had a mirror which would be able to show the entire floor of the people at various desks and see what they were doing, and people didn't like that very much, but there was no law against it. He was able to have surveillance of everything going on in the office. I had another appointment or a field work assignment at Community Service Society, which was a very treasured kind of a fieldwork appointment, because it was and probably still is one of the highly professional type of social service organizations. The New York School at that time, there was a lot of debate over various approaches to helping people with psychological problems, and the New York School was noted as a Freudian school. As opposed to the Pennsylvania school, which I think was called a Ronkian school. At that time, I probably knew the difference. And my assignment was counseling and with clients. But I never was very comfortable with the Freudian approach. I guess I just couldn't accept it entirely. I think the one event that stands out in my counseling was one of my clients was a young man, probably about my age, early 20s, and I remember we used to give him some money to look for a job and do other things, and he said he needed a suit to really go out and look for a job, and I remember giving him something like $20 or so for a suit, and next time, or whatever it was, maybe I paid him the money after he got the suit, because I know when he came back and told me that he had bought a suit and he wanted to be reimbursed, that I was really realized that he was spending more for a suit than I was. And I gave him the money with some trepidation, but my supervisor said that was very good, I was doing very well. But at any rate, when the opportunity, I had taken a federal civil service exam, and I got a telegram somewhere around the late December or thereabouts telling me that I was being offered a job in what was then called the Social Security Administration, which included a manpower office, which was subsequently moved to another part of the administration. But I think I was glad to get it because it gave me a reason to leave the School of Social Work, because I think I never felt that I wanted to be a social worker. And I went to Washington, I think I started on January 1st during the war. This was January 1st, 1942, and we didn't observe any holidays. and we worked that day, and I stayed there until I was drafted into the service in about November or December of 1942, and was in the service until November of 1945, most of the time in the United States, but during the latter part, during 1945, after the war in Europe had ended, was shipped out into the Pacific and was stationed at Biak, which is an island part of New Guinea, or off the coast of New Guinea, for a while, and then we went to Manila, probably after the war was over with Japan, and then I was discharged sometime in late 1945. And went back since I had been in I had my government, my veterans' rights to return to government. I went to work for the Office of the Housing Expediter, which was headed by Wilson Wyatt, who was a former mayor of Louisville and an up-and-coming political figure often talked of as a presidential candidate. The Office of the Housing Expediter, the purpose of the office was to build low-cost housing for veterans, but there was so much competition for construction materials that we couldn't get enough materials for the veterans' housing. It was all going for racetracks and other kinds of more important things. And finally, Wyatt resigned in protest, and eventually the agency folded, and I went to work for another agency. I can't remember the exact name, but more in the same field for, but that agency also was dissolved shortly thereafter, and that was about 1947, and I learned through various the grapevine that there were schools of industrial relations. Illinois was starting one, Minnesota had one, Cornell had one, and I think I probably applied to a few, and the first one that answered was Minnesota, and I accepted a graduate assistantship there, and I think it paid about $300 a year, which was very good, and went out to Minneapolis, and I probably wasn't sure at that time that I was going to go on for a PhD, but I finished a master's degree there by December of 1948, and would probably have continued, but I got a call from Otis Brubaker, who had worked with me in the housing agency, and he was now research director of the Steelworkers Union, and he asked me if I was interested in working for the union, and I said, well, I'd, you know, be willing to consider it, and I came down to Pittsburgh and waited around all day to see Philip Murray, and finally about 4 o'clock the call came that the president of the union would see me, and I went downstairs, and there wasn't much, it was more of a very cursory kind of interview. I think Murray was there, and I think the vice president, Jim Timmies, T-H-I-M-M-E-S, was also present. But sometime during the interview, I heard a voice in the back, probably somebody who had just entered, saying, "Are you a member of the Communist Party?" And I looked around, and that was David McDonald, who was then the secretary treasurer of the union, and I thought maybe he was kidding. But he looked pretty serious, and I guess, I don't know, I must have responded in an acceptable way, because I got the job. Stayed with the steelworkers for 2 years in the research department, which then consisted of Brubaker and myself and Meyer Bernstein. Towards the end of 1950, the Korean War started, and the labor movement was asked to send some people this. Yeah, I remember. All right. So at that time, the war had just started, and President Truman asked Philip Murray, who was then president of both the AFL, both president of the CIO and the Steelworkers Union, to send some people down to be engaged in various aspects of the war effort. And Murray agreed to do it. However, he said that that during the World War II, they had sent a lot of top-level people, presidents of unions and other high-level officials, and they had been given very high-level jobs where they were really not in a position to influence the operating whatever was going on at the operating level. They were very well paid and had nice offices, but that this time he felt that they ought to send people at a middle level so that they would have a more direct involvement in the war effort, and that was agreed to. And he then asked me if I wanted to go down to Washington, and I was willing to do that. So I went down there in about December of 1950. There were four of us appointed. In fact, if you want to, I can give you a clipping from Fortune magazine in which the four of us were pictured and briefly identified. There was George L.P. Weaver, who was then assistant to Jim Carrey of the UE, Electrical Workers Union. I can't remember if they had, I think it was still called UE. Everett Casselow, who had been probably working for the rubber workers, high bookbinder, who was coming from the Amalgamated Clothing Workers or the ILG, I'm not sure which, and myself. There were four of us. And we were assigned to the National Security Resources Board because it seemed like that was going to be a major agency in the war effort.
Which agency?
NSRB. National Security Resources Board, which was headed up by Stuart Symington. But between the time we were assigned down there and the time we got there, the whole picture changed. The President Truman had appointed Charlie Wilson of GE to be sort of the major czar in the whole war effort, and they had shifted responsibilities of the NSRB to other agencies, and therefore there wasn't really much to do there. But shortly after I got there, the Wage Stabilization Board had been established. It was a tripartite board made up of labor, industry, and public members to resolve disputes that could interfere with war production. And they had had a falling out. Labor members had walked out of that board because of a dispute over certain policy issues. But eventually they did go back after they were resolved, and I went to work for the Wage Stabilization Board as the executive assistant, I think I became executive assistant. There was another person who was above me who had come from the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, Textile Workers, Emil Reeve's organization. And then he left somewhere in the middle, and I became executive assistant to the CIO members of the board. There was also an AFL, they weren't merged at that time, an AFL section with an assistant. And it was during that period that, because labor members of the board, being presidents, mostly presidents or other highly placed officers of their unions, really were not able to spend much time at the board and give full time, that they relied a lot more on staff. Therefore I was in a position to deal directly with other members of the board, and especially the public members. And it was in the course of that kind of meeting one day that John Dunlop, who was a professor at Harvard and a public member of the board, asked me a little about my my background and so on, and said, why don't you go and get a PhD? You've got a master's degree, and you ought to finish up. And I had just seen this movie called Zorba the Greek, and I seem to remember one of the scenes in the movie was where he's going over on a boat with some British actor, can't remember his name, Alan Bates. And they are talking, and Alan Bates asks him about himself, and he said, are you married, and so on and so forth, and he says, the entire catastrophe, wife, children, everything. So I said, I couldn't afford to go back to school. I've married, I have one child, another one on the way. And Dunlop said, well, he said, I'll make a deal with you. He said, you know anything about the CWS program, Cooperative Wage Study, which the steel industry and the union had recently negotiated after a directive from the War Labor Board going back to the Second World War. And while I had not been in that department, I said I knew a little about it. It was another department. And he said, well, he said, if you would be agreeable to doing that as a PhD thesis, and then if it's good enough, we'll publish it, we could possibly work out some financial arrangements. So that's how I ended up at Harvard in 1952, and spent 4 years there, and Dunlop was as good as his word. I still had the GI Bill, which again was quite accidental, because while I was working for the board one day, I was having lunch with a former classmate of mine in college who was a professor at George Washington University. And he pointed out to me that if I didn't take some coursework, that my GI Bill would run out of time. So it was in the middle of the term, and he said, if you sign up for a readings course with me, or something that we now call a readings course, I think we could then consider that to be part of your academic work. And I did take two courses with him, writing about the Wage Stabilization Board. And then, so I still had the GI Bill, and I went to Harvard, and I worked on the steel industry wage structure, which subsequently was published by the Harvard University Press. And I finished my degree in 1955, but I was, in the last 2 years, I was working as a graduate assistant at the Harvard Business School, writing case studies. And then when I got my degree in 1956, I interviewed at the American Economic Association meetings, and Professor Killingsworth was there, and they were just starting up the Industrial Relations Center, as it was then called. And he offered me a job as associate director for the research program. I thought that was something that I wanted to do. I liked the idea about being in an industrial relations program. At that point, I could have stayed at the Harvard Business School. I was offered a job there as an assistant professor, but I felt that I advise students now the same way, if you stay in the same school in which you get your PhD, no matter how long you stay there and how old you are, you're always considered sort of a student, because the professors for whom you worked or whom you took your courses under are still around, and they still remember you as a student and not as a colleague so much. So that, as well as other things that I liked about the center, led me to come here. We came in 1956. And during the first 3 years, the program then had only three parts to it: a labor program service, which provided educational services for unions, a personal management program service, which did the same thing for management, and the research program, which was focused primarily on automation, which was then a very much discussed and controversial topic. And especially in Michigan, there was a great deal of concern that automation would lead to a large-scale unemployment, So the legislature was interested in that, and that was the focus of much of our research at that time. And none of the people in the center had appointments in the center because all of the appointments were in the various departments. So my appointment was in the economics department. A few others were appointed either in economics or political science, maybe sociology, and we had a large number of joint appointments who would be assigned about either a quarter or a half time to the center to do research or to work in the various, in the two outreach programs. And then in 1959, Professor Killingsworth decided to give up the directorship. I remember I was in Scotland at the time. I was on leave to teach at some program in Scotland, and I was in Dundee. I remember getting a phone call about 6 o'clock in the morning, which means that it must have been made about 12 o'clock at night here. I was shaving, and somebody said I was staying in a private house. We were on a tour to give a few lectures, and I was called to the phone, and it was Paul Miller, who was then the provost of the university, and said that they wanted to ask me if I would be willing to be director of the school. And after thinking it over for 24 hours, I wired back and accepted the job and came back at that time and became director of the school in 1969. So that's how I got here. Now maybe I can respond more directly to your questions if you have any.
Quite all right. I just want to go back and ask you a couple of quick questions, Jack, a couple of things that you raised. The basic storyline on the Wage Stabilization Board is covered in your labor history article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Okay. That's right. Yeah, that's right. I did write an article on that.
Okay. I'll just follow up. The first years, the staff, the first couple of years during Dr. Killingsworth, who were the other faculty members in the center?
Well, Dalton McFarlane was the associate director for PMPS. Fred Haler was the associate director for the Labor Program Service. There was another person. They had had some labor education work here before out of continuing education. I can't remember his name. He sort of moved over into the labor program service. I'm sure it's in the record someplace. Those were the only staff members in 1956. Bob Ripas was hired in 1957. Dan Kruger was hired in the Personnel Management Program Service in 1957. And sometime shortly after that, whether it was 57 or 58, McFarland, who was a professor in the business school, decided that he wanted to go back full-time to his business school appointment. And Professor Killingsworth hired a lawyer named Chuck Rogers, who became the associate director for the Personnel Management Program Service. And I think those were the only appointments. We had some secretarial help, of course. We were located in the basement of Kellogg Center at the time.
What about Lance LaRue?
Well, LaRue was hired at the same time I was. He wasn't then called Lash LaRue. He was, like the rest of us, dressed in a suit with a tie. And Charles P. LaRue, we used Chuck LaRue, and he was hired in the economics department, and he was one of our joint appointments. I'm quite sure that he was a joint appointment in the research, because I remember he did his research on the Harry Bridges and the Longshoremen's Union under our auspices, and also wrote an article on the demise of the Foreman's Union in Detroit. He may have been doing some teaching for LPS, but I think his primary assignment was in research. But we had a lot of people on joint appointment. Probably half a dozen people from economics, and some people from psychology and sociology, speech, and labor program, there were a large number of joint appointments.
Do you think in some ways that was a better model?
Well, better than what?
Well, just how it compares with the full-time faculty members of the school.
Well, no, I think we didn't have an academic program in the sense of having graduate students, so there was no teaching in the school or in the center, as it was then called. And the only way in which we could get for others, because these individuals had not necessarily been hired for the jobs that they were asked to do. The research people, I think, were, because Killingsworth was also chairman of the economics department, so that LaRue and Dan Fussfeld and a number of others had been hired as labor economics people. So their research could be adapted to our needs. But there was also the negotiations with departments, and of course every year there would have to be negotiations with regard to salary increases and promotions. And since the various standards and the kind of things that the various departments were interested in were not necessarily the same kind of standards that we applied in the school, so that occasionally that could lead some problems, although during the first 3 years I wasn't very much involved in that. I think Killingsworth worked those things out. But after 1959 we still had the joint appointments, and occasionally there would be differences. We might feel that somebody was doing a very good job in the center, but the department might say for what we consider important, this person shouldn't get the very good salary increase, or really does not merit promotions. Those kind of problems are inevitable in joint appointments wherever they occur, and we had those as well as other places.
You mentioned that the major focus was automation, and of course of some interest is all the 80s discussion about new technology. Apparently lots of late 50s, early 60s was automation. Have you or somebody else that you know have written any kind of comparative thing of those two periods, pointing up sort of how this discussion affects industrial relations, and sort of to what extent everybody really worried about it then? And
well, there was a lot written. There was a lot written at the time. I know I wrote an article. I can't remember exactly where it appeared. Professor Killingsworth wrote quite a bit on automation. The IRA had programs on automation. And this continued, so that in the mid 1960s, there was also an automation commission. In fact, in 1965, the automation commission, which again I think was a presidential or maybe even a statutory body, which major purpose was to study the effects of automation on employment. And they eventually came out with a four-volume report. Garth Mangum, who was executive director of the Automation Commission, asked me to go to Europe in 1965. I spent about 6 weeks there and wrote a monograph on manpower implications of automation in Western Europe, for the most part. So there was all the research at that time, a lot of it was directed at the question of the employment effects, or possible employment effects of automation. Some people felt that it would have very serious impact on employment. I think the overall conclusion of the commission, which is available in their final report, was that it would not, that unemployment effects, potential unemployment effects, were greatly exaggerated, and I think that eventually turned out to be the case.
I guess what I was getting at, much of the same thing has happened within the last decade or more recently. same kind of fear, same kind of issues. I was just curious if anyone had written a comparative piece talking about the sort of level of discussion and raising of these issues now and then kind of thing.
I don't know. I don't know whether anybody has written anything like that. I don't believe I've seen anything like that.
Certain aspects of it strike me as being somewhat similar. In your previous, in your videotaped talk and in your unvideotaped previous talk, you've discussed the issue of the making of the state labor body, which I'm curious to what extent was a Bob Ripa's project, the impact of that, plus the impact of the PMPS director, relations with the school and some anger, and I guess from discussion with Lash LaRue, his going to somebody in the state senate. Is that Rogers? The name Rogers has come up a couple times.
He was the associate director.
Is there anything else I should add or ask of that whole story of the Senate hearing and the film, or maybe wait until I've read the transcript?
Yeah, I think although of course the transcript is it reflects the committee's interests and their questions. I don't really know whose idea the film was, because Fred Haler was the associate director. I always took it that it was his idea, whether or not internally it was Bob or somebody else who suggested it. I don't know, and it's not very important. I think the film itself was done, and you undoubtedly have seen it, or so you can judge for yourself how well done it is and any of the other kind of criticisms that there might have been of it. I don't think the film itself would necessarily have occasioned any great controversy. I think it coincided, however, with the problems in the Personnel Management Program Service, which had probably developed even before I became director. I know Professor Killingsworth, when he told me, you know, what the situation was in the school, indicated that he had been having problems with the programs of the Personnel Management Program Service, and both personal problems with the associate director, as well as programmatic problems. I think, basically, as I see it, the major issues were that the PMPS program wasn't, first of all, the whole center had one budget, and we always had combined budgets for the labor and the management program, so that if the management program made money, it could help carry the labor program, which generally lost money because services for unions were at a very nominal fee, whereas management programs were charged higher rates. Rogers always felt that this was wrong, and whenever he sort of made his reports, he would indicate what he called quote-unquote profits that PMPS was making, and that these were not really being used for PMPS. Actually, they weren't profits, because it didn't include salaries of staff and other people like that. But probably a more serious problem was the fact that his view of the personnel management program and the kind of things that ought to be taught to management practitioners could only be taught by other practitioners. That faculty members really did not have much to offer to practitioners in the field, and therefore his programs made very little use of university personnel. And that was not the basis on which we had sold the program to the administration, and why we should be in the business of providing labor and management education. Since labor unions already have education departments, and managements also have a lot of management organizations, and the reason for having them in a university was the idea that university faculty members
could bring certain kind of information and the latest kind of scholarly studies to the attention of the practitioners. But he didn't see it that way, and as a result, most of the people that taught in the management program were people who were drawn from management. So those really were the major problems, and when they couldn't be resolved, Rogers also did have an appointment in the business school as an associate professor, so there wasn't any problem of losing a job or tenure, although he had never done anything in the business school because it was understood that he was being hired actually to work in the center. So that when I, of course this had to get the approval of the board that supervised the work of the center, which was made up of, I think, five deans in the university, when we asked that he give up the directorship and go to his tenured appointment in the business school, he didn't react at all positively to that. And whether or not how it came to the attention of the legislature, I don't know personally. But eventually, the legislature then became involved and decided that there ought to be an investigation and a hearing of the Industrial Relations Center, and that's how the hearing came about. And of course, when the hearing did come about, that's when the film became a part of the controversy and was criticized as being too much pro-labor and picturing management in a bad light, even though I think that really was stretching the way in which the film really pictured both management and labor. But of course, having been made by the Labor Program Service for education of high school students and perhaps union members, would not be surprising if it had more of a labor education flavor than perhaps management people might consider to be satisfactory.
Has this story ever been written up about the film?
Not to my knowledge. At least I think it might have been written not in any scholarly publications that I'm aware of. I suppose it might have appeared in some articles and maybe a union publication or something like that, but I don't know that.
The only place I ever remember reading anything about this point, other than stuff that's come off of you doing this testimony, was the famous John Hanna position paper.
Well, there is a paper, yeah.
Which was printed in the AFL national newspaper and was utilized quite a bit in terms of the why universities, especially land grants, should be involved in worker education. Didn't that come out of this hearing?
Yeah, he presented. He was one of the witnesses at the hearing, and made a prepared statement at the hearing. I assume the transcript would indicate whether or not he also was questioned further about it. But the statement itself was a prepared statement that he submitted.
Wouldn't that be the one that's been reprinted?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you or did somebody else help draft that then, or what was the? Is there any background?
I didn't. I didn't have anything to do with where the statement that I can recall. I don't know whether anybody else did.
Fred would be the person to ask this.
Yeah, he might.
I guess it leads to a bigger question I have, which relates to sort of the relationship of President Hanna to the center and then the school, in specific in this issue or more generally?
Well, I think Hanna was very supportive of the center. It wouldn't have come into being if it hadn't been for him. And I think it goes back to a period before my time. As I recall what I had heard or maybe even read, Brendan Sexton, who was Labor Education Director of the UAW, may have approached Hanna with the idea of a labor education program. We already had some labor education going on under the continuing education rubric. So we had something there, and that may have led to the further discussions, and eventually, I don't know whether Sexton, I assume Sexton was primarily interested in labor education, but when Killingsworth became involved, I wouldn't be surprised that it was his idea, in discussions also with Hannah and others, that that the best way to structure such an organization was to focus not only on labor education, but to have labor education, personnel management education, and a research program. And I think part of the reasoning for that was that about that time, well, not about that time, probably sometime in earlier years, the University of Michigan had had a labor education program, which came to an end as a result of management criticism of the program. And I think that suggested that in order to have a program which would withstand this kind of criticism and scrutiny, one ought to not focus on only one aspect of the labor management relationship, but rather to provide services for both labor and management. And then, being a university, that we ought to also bring to bear the products of scholarly research, which could then be disseminated to practitioners in the field. So I think that was the philosophy of the program, which Hannah supported, and he also supported the all of the developments that took place, not necessarily things like whether or not you should make a film, but certainly he would have known about the decision to replace the associate director for the personnel management mm-hmm. program.
Generally, through the years of his presidency, was he supportive of the center and then the school and the change from the center to a school? And
well, he certainly, as far as the center, I don't believe that I had any contact at all with Hannah. My contacts were all with the board and Paul Miller, who was then the provost or chief academic officer, and he was the chairman of the five deans, College of Business, Arts and Letters, and so on. I don't remember the names of the various of the various colleges. And Hannah, I don't think personally got very much involved. I think he might have made a, you know, if we had a big conference, he might have been asked to welcome the group, things of that kind. But he was not any more involved in the school, and I think he, when the Labor Education Committee and the Management Advisory Committees, two separate committees, met, he met with them. We would want him to do that, so that we, since we had top figures from both labor and management, we wanted them to recognize that the top level of the university was supportive of the program. But that was, I think, the extent of his involvement. Until, of course, the Senate investigation in 1961 or early 1962. I can't remember the exact dates.
When did we stop having the university president meet with the advisory committees? We haven't done that in the last dozen years.
Well, I don't really remember, and now that you mention it, I couldn't even say for sure that the president always met with them. Mm-hmm. I think the president, and that was true later on too, if there were problems, if labor people felt that the budget of the school was not adequate, or the budget for the labor program was not adequate, and I would try to respond in terms of what our budgetary resources were, and that we'd be delighted if we could get more money. The only place that could come from was from the university. So the president would meet with them, and that was true later on too. We met, I know, for example, Woody Varner, who was then director of continuing education. which was also involved in the program. And subsequently, I know that we met with President Wharton after he became president, not on a regular basis, but again, if there were problems. And I know that I remember having at least one meeting when President Mackey was there in his office. In other words, if there were things that could only be resolved as a result of a top-level presidential decision, then we asked the president if he would meet with the appropriate advisory committee. Generally, it was the Labor Advisory Committee, which was always much more active than the Management Advisory Committee.
I don't know if there's any more that I should ask you in terms of the change from center to school.
Well, I think the investigation and the hearing lasted a couple of days, and eventually it was no surprise, given the composition of the board, two Republican members, one Democratic member. At that time, the state legislature was overwhelmingly Republican, probably in both houses, came out with a recommendation that university funds should not be used for the Labor and Industrial Relations Center. Since the center, since the Board of Trustees had the final say on this, because Michigan State University University of Michigan and Wayne State are autonomous bodies with full constitutional authority, they did not have to follow that recommendation. And they decided that there was no reason to discontinue the program. And since at least after the first year or two, we were no longer a line item, we were part of the overall university budget, it was really up to the university to distribute the university budget as it saw fit. So that the recommendation did not have any effect on the continuation of the school, but it was President Hanna's idea that the center ought to be, instead of being under his direct supervision or direct line of authority through the board, that we ought to be part of a college. And at that time, the College of Arts and Sciences was being separated into three separate colleges: College of Social Science, the College of Natural Science, and the College of Business. And he then decided that we should be in the College of Social Science, and under the indirect line of authority of a dean. In other words, this would provide what he felt, and I think probably there was some merit to it, would provide the kind of buffer protection against any other kinds of attacks on the school, similar to that had occurred earlier. It wasn't his idea necessarily to have an academic program. I think he may have suggested that we ought to look into it, and we did at that time. I'm sure that this was also part of the discussion with the first dean of the College of Social Science, Dean Lou McQuitty, and we then eventually decided that we would offer a master's degree program, and it would only be at the graduate level. That was done as a result of a faculty committee recommendation, which we then put into effect in the school, and the name of the program and the name of the center was also changed, making it a school, I suppose, because with an academic program, there are other schools in the university, a School of Social Work and so on, so that our name was changed to the School of Labor and Industrial Relations. So I think it's fair to say that really the initiative on this came from President Hanna. had he said, well, we'll just go on as we are, whether or not we might still have initiated the idea of an academic program. There were always faculty members that felt we ought to have one, but we would not have chosen to be in a college. One always feels that if you're in the office of the president, you sound more important than if you're in a college. But that decision was his decision on the way in which the place of the school and the university was to be structured, being in a college of social science.
How did it happen that you switched from line item to regular? Was that completely fortuitous?
I didn't have anything to do with it. That was done before I became director. Nobody could foresee that there would be problems of this kind. I think probably it might have been a university decision, because the university may have felt that why should this program be different than other programs, that it should be part of the university budget. But I don't know anything about that.
Any other times besides the film hearings that turned out to be very important, valuable tool, or was that the main?
No, that would be the only time that the budget was being directly influenced. Of course, it may not have made that much difference, because even if you're part of a university budget, the legislature can accomplish its will by reducing your budget by a certain amount of money, which would then be indicated as if they wanted that to come out of the budget of any part of the university. As far as I know, they didn't do that, so that while there may have been a recommendation that the center be abolished, in terms of appropriations, I guess it didn't have much effect.
I'm only curious because that's been, since a couple times in the last dozen years, been raised, and I guess I think it's a foolish idea to have anything on a line item that doesn't need to be. But I was curious if...
Yeah, well, I think I've always felt, and I know from what I have seen in other programs at other universities, where industrial relations programs are line items, that it does often result in an undue influence by outside interests who are able to apply pressure, lobbying pressure in the legislature, and therefore the program itself is beholden to either management or labor or both, rather than to the university. So that I think in general it's not a good idea to be a line item, but we're probably pretty unusual in that regard, because I know a lot of the other centers do get money directly from the legislature.
We're also somewhat unusual but not totally unique in having people on regular tenure track or tenured positions without PhDs. Is there a story behind that?
Well, I think we were probably one of the earliest universities to do that. I think now there are other universities that provide tenure to people in labor and personnel management education. We accomplished that in 1961, I believe. And I think at that time there was no major problem about the terminal degree. I think that it's not an issue, but that has sometimes been raised in more recent years. But because we had such a long history and practice of having only a master's degree requirement that we could always make a strong case for saying that if you now were to impose a PhD requirement on future hires, there would be a disparate treatment between people who have already been here for a large number of years and who have not gotten the PhD, and then requiring it of new people. Of course, the other argument that we've always made is that that the best people are often not people who have earned PhDs. They often come out of the labor movement or in the management. PMPS, they come out of management, and therefore the PhD should not be a requirement, because these people are not primarily hired for research, although they do research of a different kind, but that's the kind of research they can do with less than a PhD degree. And even though I think it
started by asking you about the Rebus case involving his...
Are you on?
Yes, and we're back.
Well, what I was saying is that from my view, the university gave Bob all of the support that they would have given any faculty member, and to which a faculty member would be entitled. Namely, we rejected the view that we should not allow him to teach certain classes of certain unions. We said we would make the assignments if they didn't. If the union didn't want members to sign up, there's nothing we could do. That we felt that he had not done anything outside of the realm of academic freedom to teach what he thought he ought to be teaching, that he was a very experienced instructor. We didn't give him any penalty. As a matter of fact, as I recall, he got the largest categories in which we give increases. It so happened that that very year he got a superior increase because of not necessarily his teaching in that program, but just his performance overall. I think the one area in which he could not reach any agreement was that he felt that we should that we should more or less go head to head with the UAW and the AFL-CIO. And make it an issue between these bodies, and charging them with the violation of academic freedom and so on. And we didn't think that. I guess I never felt that either of those bodies really were the guardians of academic freedom. In other words, the UAW doesn't profess to support academic freedom. They don't have to. They're not a university, and in other words, their view is we have to do things that we think are best for our members, for our union, and academic freedom may not necessarily be that sort of thing. So I think those were the main differences that arose, and eventually I think the decision was that in a sense I think it supported his view that the university ought to write to the UAW, which we did, that is through the dean. I can't even remember exactly what it was that the letter was to say. And I think that we just wrote and said that we felt that they, by protesting his teaching, that they were violating academic freedom and so on and so forth.
And Bob wanted you to do what in addition to that letter? What was
he
grieving that the FG?
I don't really remember the details. I think he wanted me to do it. I wouldn't do it because I felt that it was not in the best interests of the school to take on the UAW and the state AFL-CIO, that our interest was simply in protecting the faculty member and not letting them interfere with his academic freedom. And when the decision was made, I didn't have any objection to the dean writing the letter, because the dean has no relationship with these bodies. And Bob, I think, was still not satisfied, because eventually she wrote the letter to the regional director, or maybe she wrote the letter to the president of the UAW, and he wanted the letter to go, I suppose, as wide as possible, certainly to all of the regional directors and maybe to the whole membership. I don't know, but that eventually just remained, because the decision of the grievance panel was only that the university should make known its views to the UAW in a letter, and they didn't indicate who the letter was to go to or anything of that kind.
Okay. I don't even know the details, but I know since that point there was both some level of investigation or discussion by Workers' Education 189 and UCLEA about the issues of academic freedom. And
they never reached me.
Committee, which Dale, I think, was the giver of testimony in UCLEA, recently reported that it's still talking.
Finish this off, maybe.
Oh, you don't want to really finish. 22nd of February. Last area we were talking about was the REPUS grievance, and we had talked about grievances in general. I had a couple others in terms of sort of the relationship of unions to the universities over the years. Were there various instances over the years of that where there were problems?
Well, the unions, I don't know about how it's now. The Labor Advisory Committee has always, at least, I don't know, the last 5 years, you probably know more about that. Have they been meeting annually?
Uh-huh.
Who's chairman now?
The president of the...
Oh, the Garrison?
No. The Labor Advisory Committee is chaired by the president of the AFSCME 1585, Larry Smith, on campus. He happens to be on my regional committee, and they elected him for the state committee.
Yeah. Well, I think the Labor Advisory Committee, during all of the period that I can recall, has always been very active. Trying to exercise and exert more control over what I would consider internal aspects of the labor program than I would consider to be their role. For example, they've tried to influence the directorship of the program on one occasion.
That was in the Jackie Brophy change point?
Well, I don't want to, go into the detail. We've only had one major change of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
And on that, it was really in opposition to the more or less unanimous judgment, not only of the faculty as a whole, but the including all of the LPS faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, the faculty's judgment and selection was approved by the board, but only with the assistance of the Republican members of the board. On another occasion, I guess the more recent one is the REPUS occasion,
mm-hmm.
when they took a very strong position on Bob's teaching, and again we took the position that he was exercising his rights as an instructor, and that we didn't see mm-hmm. that there was any action that we could take. Again, eventually, I think, despite the fact that Bob wasn't entirely satisfied with mm-hmm. the way in which the university internally handled the matter, but I would say that, again, the views of the school prevailed over what the Labor Advisory Committee would have wanted to do.
It seemed to me there might have been a couple smaller issues, one with before maybe Hernandez was hired, and maybe one related to a D. Lyons.
Well, that's right. There was another occasion on hiring in the LPS. Not, as far as I know, there wasn't anything as far as Husto was concerned that I was involved in. It, perhaps there may have been some discussions at the level of the director of the labor program, but by the time it came to me for the appointment process, I was not aware of any problems. I think on Lyons, again, that I was on sabbatical when it occurred, and it's only when I came back that I learned that, again, that with the, that in this case, really, it was with the action. Again, we had an acting president at that time, and when I returned from sabbatical, I found that Ms. Lyons had been, at least the action had not yet been taken, but I think the general approach was that she was to be given what would have amounted to a tenure system position. I think we were able to persuade. I met with the acting president at that time, which was Hardin, and it was turned around so that I think she may have stayed on for a few months, but then something was worked out whereby she went to work in Oakland. But I think these are all illustrations of the problems that are potentially present when there is any advisory group that feels very strongly about a program which affects them, and on some occasions, and I suppose when you consider that we're talking about a period of 25 years, if there's been maybe as much as half a dozen occasions, that's not terribly excessive, but those kinds of things have happened. Management Advisory Committee, the only time we ever had any problems were during the Rogers affair. They have never been as, because they come from, they're not a cohesive body, and they are appointed as individuals rather than by organizations. They have not tried to influence the management program to the same extent. And we've never had that kind of trouble except in Rogers, and even in the Rogers affair, of course, the management advisory committee did not support Rogers. It was more a legislative matter because I think, in effect, they knew him better than I did, and they were not as surprised as perhaps some of us might have been at the ruckus that developed at that time.
You were just saying that it was one of the times they were more active, even.
Well, they weren't really active. I think it was a matter that they had, they were interested because, after all, this was the program that they were advising, and they had to be persuaded that the school was taking a sound position, and that we were not doing anything that would adversely affect the management program. On the contrary, it was being done in order to promote the management program more effectively.
Another thing I remember during the years I've been here, a little bit different, but an area where the Labor Advisory Committee had a lot of interest was concerning credit labor studies. That was
Well, there was always and again, I think this is where probably the Labor Advisory Committee and the LPS faculty were pretty much on one side in trying to develop a program of credit. But I think there the internal problems, not only in the school, but in the university as a whole, to try to develop a program which would be appropriate for people in labor unions who would not meet the normal criteria for credit programs, as well as the general differences among the academic faculty in the school was the issue in that kind of a case. And that's sort of just been something that cropped up from time to time, but never really came to any any major head or problems. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware that there has been any discussion of it in the past several years.
It's come up at the advisory committee barely. But it was a much bigger issue in the late 60s and through the early 70s. And
yeah, well, I think generally speaking, my view has always been, and I think events have borne out, the wisdom of that approach is that while it's important to have advisory committees, a program, whether it's a management program or a labor program, cannot become so dependent and beholden to any outside group to the extent that the program itself would have to be conducted in a way which might be different from the way in which the faculty itself would prefer to conduct it. Other universities have not followed that approach, and I think they have had some real problems. I would guess the one that comes to mind most is Rutgers University. While the labor program, on the other hand, has been helpful in terms of trying to help in getting appropriations, which like the minority mm-hmm. program, and on other occasions they have met. I don't know about the last 5 years, but every president from Hanna through Wharton, not the temporary presidents, but Mackey, all on at least one occasion, and sometimes on more than one occasion, had a meeting with the president in which we discussed some of the problems of the school as a whole, the labor program service, and just to make sure that the president understood the role of the labor program service in the total structure of the school, and to exert whatever influence could be exerted in order to get the appropriations, not directly from the legislature, but through the university, that was needed in the school.
Was that ever a program, a problem educating provosts or deans about the program services also, or?
Well, there always is an educational problem, but I think the deans, there were three deans actually since the school was established, McQuitty, Winder, and Gwen Andrew, and then more recently the latest dean, whom I have had no contact with because I wasn't director while he was the dean. I suppose you might say there's always a need for education because the deans come from other departments that don't have the outreach programs that we do, but all of them were very, once they understood the role, were very supportive, and I don't think that we've never had a either salary adjustments or promotions that were recommended by the school, even though with regard to the labor and the management program, they had to be considered on a different basis than for the academic program. Still, they were always approved by the dean and were approved by the Board of Trustees. So,
were there ever any major issues about the extension people not having PhDs or the lesser amount of research conducted by
those
people?
Were always continuing issues. In other words, every time I would be recommending a promotion, it had to be explained that the qualifications and the standards that are applied to faculty generally could not be applied to to this group. And I think, again, the fact that we've been able to continue that over the years indicates that we were successful, although I think there was always some hesitation, and no doubt the provost certainly, I don't think we ever had any that kind of a problem with the dean, because there was more contact, and Dean Andrew, could examine the qualifications and the reasons why we were recommending a person without a PhD sometimes over a person with a PhD who was being considered by the labor program. So that while I think at the provost level they would have preferred that we would follow the same kind of standards that the university generally did, we were not required to do so. I think in the future, of course, when there are vacancies, my guess is that there will be candidates more often with PhDs than there were in the past, so that maybe this won't be a problem. But I think at the present time, none of our LPS faculty have PhDs.
No, right? We had two in recent years, but neither of those two are with us right now. So.
Who was that?
Carol after leaving, or simultaneous.
Well, but that's after leaving.
And yeah. Everett while he was here.
Everett didn't have a PhD, did he? I
believe so.
I don't think so.
I thought so.
Where is Everett working now? I was told he had some kind of an odd job that I Rutgers for.
Yeah, I think he did.
But again, I think we, that was not forced upon us.
No.
When the position was open, we considered that he was the best qualified candidate.
As a labor educator, yes. Yeah. Any comments about research in labor educators and how that's sort of changed over time or any?
Well, the theories, when institutes and programs and industrial relations were established in universities, and the first one I can think of was really the one in which, I don't know that we could say ours was modeled at over it, but it really is most is very much the same as the Illinois program. And there's always a lot of lip service, although I think people believed it sincerely, that labor and management programs would, as well as the academic programs, would be conducting research which would then be funneled out through the community generally in the same way that at the Cooperative Extension Service. As far as I can see, that has never really turned out to be the way in which things worked. The kind of research that is done by academic faculty in credit programs and published in professional journals is generally not the kind of research that labor or management extension programs have found very useful. I think, on the other hand, some LPS and I suppose to some extent management faculty from time to time have done research like your own program on labor history, which was then able to be used in the field, and some publications in such journals as the Labor Studies Journal and other. But I would not. I think, generally speaking, labor studies faculty in our school have generally not done much research. I think their loads are such to require pretty much full-time work in the field, which does not leave much time for research except when they're on sabbatical. And I think the inclinations of the faculty who are hired for these kinds of programs are more in the direction of teaching than research. So there never has been an integration of research in our school, and I think in most other similar schools. between the extension faculty and the faculty of the schools.
Okay. I just got a couple left. One thing we've never had that some other universities have is a line item situation for their extension functions.
Well, that's exactly what I mean when I say that I think we do not have, and I think we're better off for it. Because when you have line item programs, you are dependent on the legislature rather than on the university as a whole. And when you're in that situation, you have to depend upon and often seek the aid and influence of outside groups. And the old saying, whoever controls or influences the purse strings can also influence the program. So that I think the very first year before I was the director, when we were established, there was a line item, but within a year or two, we were incorporated in the university. For example, the best example of that is if we had been a line item in 1961 when the legislature recommended that the appropriation for the, as it was then called, the Industrial Relations Center be terminated, if we had been a line item, I would expect we might not be in existence now, or if we were, it would be an entirely different program. But not being a line item, the president of the university and the board of trustees could exercise their constitutional mm-hmm. right and say, well, we have to decide how to distribute our funds. I think that line item budgets, whether it's for our program or for any other program, the only one, of course, that has a line item, and because they have a lot of political pressures, is cooperative extension.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there, because the farm community is much more in attuned and sees things the same way as the cooperative extension faculty, that works out better. But I don't think it would work out as well in a more controversial kind of area like industrial relations.
The only area where we do is the women minority
That's
program,
right.
And I didn't know if you wanted to comment a little bit about its creation and.
Well, I think that was established really. I had very little to do with it. I guess Dale was then at that time the director, and I think that was pretty well worked out and modeled in cooperation with the labor movement. And as far as I can see, there haven't been any problems, and it's the kind of line item. And again, it was, of course, not limited to Michigan State University. It really extended to six or so universities throughout the state, although we may have had the largest budget. But that has been a line item, and I don't know whether it's in jeopardy now with a tight budget, but again, I suppose as a line item, it really depends on the legislature rather than on the university. To be continued.
Is there anything else about labor education here I failed to ask you?
No, I can't. I can't think of anything offhand.
Any kind of summary thoughts in terms of labor education and its relationship to what's happened in industrial relations over the last 20 years and your involvement?
Well, I think the labor education programs have worked out well in our university and in the ones in others as far as I am acquainted with them. I think there is a continuing problem, and it's probably internally it's there's always a some differences and some inherent problems of coordinating a program where you have people of very different kind of backgrounds and roles in one program, these have to be worked out in a. I think the role of the director is more important in terms of trying to coordinate and get get a total faculty judgment, or at least a significant majority judgment on questions where the individuals in the extension programs and the academic programs may not see things the same way.
You're referring to the director or the associate director in that comment?
Oh, the director, because the associate director may generally would see things the same way as the people in the program that he or she is directing. To the extent that there may be differences within a program, that's no different than in the academic program, where a faculty member might not be satisfied with, let's say, the associate director for the academic program in terms of course assignments or evaluations and things of that kind. In that case, it's not essentially different, where there might be a difference between an individual faculty member in the labor program with the way in which the associate director has evaluated that person's performance. But I think where there may be a more essential difference on issues within the school as a whole, then there has to be a working out of those differences so that there will be a general acceptance of whatever is agreed upon.
Any final comments about major accomplishments or disappointments in terms of the school's extension functions? Or
no, I don't have any disappointments. I think there have been, from time to time, there may have been some differences. I think the LPS program, generally speaking, has been run more independently than you might say the management program, in the sense that the directors of the program have always had very close ties with the labor movement, and therefore they could do things on their own, which most of the time I would be in agreement with, but on some occasions, if there were some differences, they had to be worked out even after.